Well, the pressure is building on black economic empowerment. It is being exposed as a mirage, which was supposed to have supported and helped those who were affected, particularly economically, by the apartheid regime. In fact, it's done the opposite. It's made lives worse for the majority of South Africa's population and only enriched a few. We are going to continue along this theme today with Dr. Anthea Jeffrey, who's got some interesting insights. It's called The Economic Empowerment for Disadvantage, the EED, as a alternative to BEE. It's a story that's been on BizNews that she wrote, which has been extremely well read. We're going to pick up on it in a moment. Anthea, thank you for joining us. The whole BEE story is now suddenly coming into the spotlight, I guess helped along a little by, although love him or hate him, the chaotic Donald Trump has certainly shone a spotlight onto what the ANC has been up to in the last 30 years, something that it seemed to have been given a free pass on from most people around the world, including the United States.
I think that's right. And I think that for very many years, the narrative was always that there might be the odd problem with BEE, but really the solution was just to ratchet up the rules and then to implement it more strongly, and then it would be even more successful. And I think there has been a reluctance until now to acknowledge the extent to which it's widened inequality. As you were saying, that it helps perhaps 10-15% of the black population, the people who are the best skilled, the most credentialed, often the best politically connected. And it's harmed the remaining 85%. And I think that realization is really beginning to hit home. There have always been some acknowledgements of that. Interestingly, some of them coming from very senior figures within the ANC, with Pravin Gordhan back in 2010, for example, saying that BEE hadn't worked, hadn't made South Africa a fairer society, had helped the few rather than the many. And the SACP in 2017 saying that it was the main reason for our rising Gini coefficient, because it had so contributed to intra-black inequality. Again, same picture. It's the small group at the top that benefit, the great majority who don't. And then the gap between the two of them widens. So we now do, fortunately, I think, have a widening recognition that BEE is not working. Perhaps it's also triggered by the fact that we have yet another year of meager economic growth at 0.6% of GDP against population growth of 1.3% of GDP. So obviously the entire population is getting poorer year by year on a per capita basis. We need to break the mold. And since BEE is something that deters investment, hampers growth, worsens unemployment, it really deserves critical scrutiny, and we believe the development of an alternative.
Unfortunately, it also is benefiting the few who are incredibly powerful within the decisions or shaping political decisions. How might their minds be changed? Are they going to have to be bought off by some other policy to actually give up these wonderful gains? And you just think of various sectors of the population who have benefited hugely from BEE. Many of them, talking to Gabriel Krauss recently, he unpacked, your colleague at the IRR, he unpacked the cost of BEE being around 150 billion a year, rands a year, as that's just an extraordinary layer on top of everything else. And we all know about this, but those who are getting the 150 billion are certainly not going to give it up without a fight.
Yes, that's right. And the 150 billion he talks about is only in the public procurement context. And BEE obviously has many costs beyond that. But certainly there are entrenched interests, and people will fight to retain the current system because it does work for the few. And it has made a relatively small number of people extremely wealthy. And also, I've probably given them a sense of power over business. So nobody wants to give up that. But if we can just make the voice of the ordinary people emerge more strongly, perhaps that can be a powerful countervailing factor, because the Institute has been polling black South Africans on BEE and on some aspects of our EED proposal for a number of years. And with the EED idea, we particularly want to do something that will reach down to the grassroots, that will help the most disadvantaged get ahead by equipping them with better education, better healthcare, better housing. And international experience shows that you can do that through tax-funded vouchers. So we've been asking people, what do they think about vouchers? And in our last polling in 2024, there were 92% of Black respondents who really liked the idea of schooling vouchers. 83% supported healthcare vouchers. They wanted to have them. 80% were in favor of housing vouchers. And when we asked people if they thought the vouchers would be more effective than BEE in helping them to get ahead, 81% of Black respondents said yes. And this is a consistent picture that goes back to 2016 when we first began asking this question. So if the political parties could tap into what ordinary South Africans think and want, and then provide a very clear message that this is what they would introduce if given the power to rule, then perhaps this would help to break the logjam where people know that the ANC government is not working for them, but they haven't switched ready considerably to alternatives yet, not enough. We saw a big shift, of course, in the 2024 election, but we need a bigger shift still.
Those vouchers, have they been used elsewhere to good effect?
Yes, they have been. India has a very big voucher program at primary school level, which is run in all private schools. But there are vouchers also in many other countries. And the idea was really a simple one. Initially, the whole assumption was that government must not only fund education, which of course makes sense, but must also deliver it. And when you have state delivery, it turns to become top-down, centralized, bureaucratic. Nobody really gets good service from it, and the bureaucrats who run it are not affected if the schooling system is not good. If anything, they're likely to be more bureaucrats and more money to solve the problem next year. So somebody called James Tooley, who I think is quite well known, he's now the Vice Chancellor of the University of Buckingham, has been studying this problem. And the fact that in developing countries all around the world, in India, in Africa particularly, parents have been voting with their children's feet by taking them out of free but dysfunctional state schools and sending them to private schools, very low-cost schools. Here in South Africa, we have such a high level of unemployment that it really is difficult to imagine that many people would be able to afford even low-cost private schools. But if they are equipped with tax-funded vouchers, then this becomes viable. And the great merit of the voucher system, as Professor Tooley has pointed out, is that it gives everybody an incentive to compete. So the idea is that you work out how much of the education budget is going to low-income households at the moment and being badly spent by bureaucrats. And instead, you divide it, that amount, among the low-income households, and you transfer that amount to households for use only for education as vouchers. And then parents can choose what school they would like their children to go to. And the school uses the voucher money to pay all their operating expenses, including teacher salaries. And that means that they have a powerful incentive to make sure that they are attracting more pupils, which means that they must increase their performance. And we have so many public schools at the moment which are really dysfunctional, which are not doing well. And our failing public schools would now receive a reason, an incentive to up their performance. Whereas the fact that there also now are many people with vouchers, there is effective demand, as it were, in the economy, would mean that many other businesses would also be keen to start meeting this demand. And so you would have an increasing pool of schools that are competing for the vouchers of parents who have a real choice and who know that the schools that they are sending their children to have incentives to compete with one another, have incentives to innovate, to push quality up and hold prices down. And it's worked well in a number of countries where the children at private schools, some of them voucher funded, some of them with parents paying, generally do better than the public schools. And that's why parents move away from the free but dysfunctional public schools to ones that work better. And we can aid that process and really help the truly disadvantaged by taking the money away from the bureaucrats and giving it to the families.
It's an irresistible idea. It makes a lot of sense. It's very logical. But so too is the argument against BEE. And yet you get some very smart people like Professor Pierre de Vos, and you quoted in your article another professor as well, who both, Christy van der Vesthuizen, who both said that the whole situation or the whole argument against BEE is a white right agenda. We're hearing a lot of that lately. Seems whenever one puts a logical suggestion forward, you become a white supremacist or a right winger or something along that. I want to unpack that in a moment, but just perhaps give us some background of the IRR. You personally have studied at WITS, at Cambridge University, London University. You're a lawyer by training. And the Institute for Race Relations, just remind people what the agenda is.
Well, perhaps I should remind people that the Institute began its life in 1929, which is almost 100 years ago. And we were formed to oppose racial discrimination, to promote racial goodwill and non-racialism. And we became, I suppose, particular experts on apartheid because year after year, from 1946 onwards, we put out a yearbook, as it were, a survey of race relations in South Africa, which tracked what was being done in terms of racial laws and what the negative outcome of those racial laws was. And we pushed for a non-racial democracy. So come 1994, people who remember our former CEO, the late John Ken Bowman, may recall that what he said is South Africa most needs now is an open and non-racial democracy, not a new form of racial engineering. And we were always concerned from the time that the first employment equity bill came out in 1997 that this would take us down the path of effectively requiring race classification again. Because if you're going to treat people differently on the basis of their race, you must be able to divide them up into racial groups. And though we've never put in place the Population Registration Act, we are effectively requiring some form of supposedly voluntary racial discrimination with people choosing for them, not racial discrimination, racial classification, with people choosing for themselves what race group they belong to. But there isn't a box to say, well, I'm a South African. Of course, there have been people, even within the ANC, who said the time must come when we must put away this racial box ticking and just say we're all South Africans. We believe that time is absolutely now, that more racial classification and the use of race as a proxy for disadvantage simply does allow the relatively black elite to take advantage of the preferences to the detriment of the really poor. And in a way that, as we've been talking about, hobbles growth and means that the unemployment keeps rising and everybody in the country keeps getting poorer. So you could argue, I suppose, that we've tried for 30 years to see if BEE can work, and clearly it hasn't, except for a small group who have become rich and powerful and now have an interest in preserving it. But we need to look to the truly poor, the most disadvantaged, and find a better mechanism that will help them and get the economy growing and thriving.
I recall I'm old enough to have been reporting at the time that BEE was brought in, and some of these sweetheart deals that made people like Cyril Ramaphosa, and I remember very clearly Tokyo Sekhwali getting a huge chunk of options in Absa, which was worth over R1 billion. It was a gift. But nobody really understood how share options worked back then, in, I think it was around 97. And so it didn't, even though you were asking, is this the right way to do it, it didn't resonate with business. Business came back with the argument that, but we do need to bring people into the tent, and it will be good for ordinary South Africans or the majority of South Africans if they can see people who look like me becoming very wealthy. That argument is still in the eyes of some people, and not least the ANC government, who want to create 100 black billionaire industrialists. It looks like more of the same, doubling down on the same old policy from where I sit.
Yes, whereas, of course, if you want to have many more black billionaires, then what we need primarily is a growing, thriving economy in which there are more and more jobs to be had, and in which people are also well-equipped with skills through the schooling system. The idea that, that you can engineer a small group, yeah, it can be done, but it's being done at the cost of the wider group and of the economy, which is being hobbled all the time. So it's not a successful model. We need to look beyond that. And as I think we argued back in 1997, if you get the, if you have this open, democratic, and thriving economy, you will find upward mobility happening. It's growth that will lift all boats, and you need to lift all of them, not just the relatively few at the top.
So why hasn't it happened? What, be brutally honest with us, what is the reason why common sense was never prevailing over the BE philosophy, which, as you say, has worsened South Africa's already terrible Gini coefficient, which is the difference between rich and poor?
I think really it's people have been perhaps unaware of the underlying ideology behind all the ANC's interventions, including BEE, which is the National Democratic Revolution, intended really to hobble business and to take us closer to the point where the state has huge control over the economy. And the aim is ready to de-link people from the capitalist economy and make them entirely dependent on the state. Hence now the emphasis, for example, on public employment. Let the state employ people, and not just in the rather limited way they've been doing now, but on a much bigger basis. And of course, it's not the role of the government to create jobs, and they're not good at doing it either. What we need is a competitive, innovative, thriving private sector that will do a much better job, especially than our ANC government can do. But there's been a tendency to ignore this underlying ideology in the media among other commentators. And certainly when I spoke to business in 1995, 96 about how they saw affirmative action, all the sort of captains of industry that I spoke to said we're absolutely in favor of providing a leg up to people who've been disadvantaged in the past. We want to do everything possible in our particular companies to make it easier for people to rise into positions of power and influence. But they said the idea of racial quotas is just something that's going to be very damaging. And we've gone the path of racial quotas. The moment you introduce them, they become very different, difficult for business to comply with because we haven't got the skills pool right. And then I think big business becomes increasingly wary of speaking out because the law is so hard to comply with that they don't perhaps want to put their heads above the parapet and attract negative attention. It becomes a factor in why most businesses go along to get along. And at the same time, the media really has been, I think, given, has abdicated some of its responsibility, I would say, to report accurately on what BEE has achieved. And the judges, I would say, have also failed to do a proper job. And maybe this is worth going back to what the Constitutional Court said back in 2004 in a case which concerned really a sort of element of affirmative action. We have in Section 9 of the Constitution a very clear commitment to equality before the law, a prohibition on unfair racial discrimination, a clause in 9.5 that says any discrimination on race is unfair unless the contrary is shown. And that was used in the case to say that it's not fair and the onus now lies in the state to prove that it is fair. That was rejected by Tikon Maseneke in the Constitutional Court on the basis that a remedial action couldn't be presumed to be unfair. But, he said, it would have to satisfy three tests. First, it would have to target the disadvantaged. And of course, we know that BEE, after 30 years, is really targeting the black elite, not the truly disadvantaged. Secondly, it would help to help them advance. And we can see that the great majority are hurt by BEE because the inefficiency in the state has so declined, because so much money, as Gabriel says, is being wasted in public procurement. And because we're not attracting the investment, because the private sector is also hobbled by BEE. And that means less growth, less jobs, more poverty. So the second test is not being fulfilled. And then the third one is that it must achieve equality. But we're not achieving equality. We're pushing up inequality, as the SACP acknowledged in 2017. Because of the intra-black inequality in particular, we have a higher Gini coefficient now at 63 in 2022 compared to 59 in 1994. None of those tests are being met. And it ought therefore to be easy to get the media to express concern that these legal tests for constitutionality have not been met. Easy also for the courts to start rowing back from their what has seemed implicit support for so-called transformation and saying we need to look beyond the words to what the outcomes have been. It's all very well to have an intent to provide redress, but if in practice you are hindering the poorest from getting ahead, then we need to think again, look back to what our constitution says and make sure that what we're doing is really in keeping with it. And what the institute is promoting by EED would be in keeping with the constitution and would be effective in growing the economy and in helping the most disadvantaged. So what we're really appealing for, I suppose, is a sea change. There has been, as you said at the beginning, a greater awareness of the problems with BEE. Some indication from Stephen Kroetis a little while ago, but we don't know what else would replace it. And now we really need to focus on what else could replace it. And the EED idea is one such idea. We believe that it would be, that would meet the need in a very comprehensive way. Of course, it could be refined. We're not saying this is the ultimate idea, but it's a good starting point. And what we really need is to recognize failure of BEE, need for an alternative, look at what the Constitution requires, as set up by Dikgang Maseneke, and move forward.
Unintended consequences, and it requires second-level thinking. Two of my favorite areas or my favorite thoughts, and one of my favorite people, Dr. Anthony Jeffrey, thank you for perhaps lifting some scales on some eyes. Anthea is the head of policy research at the Institute for Race Relations. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.